us to this meeting. But before we start, I should then maybe allow us just to quickly introduce ourselves so that we know who is here before we get the briefing. I will start with myself. My name is Dorothea Modibe, the chairperson of this portfolio committee on women, children and people with disability. Can we then go on to Member Robinson?
Afternoon everybody, I'm Denise Robinson. I greet you all and all the best for the new year. Member of this
portfolio.
I'm Manana Tlake, member of this committee.
Oh, thank you, good day. I'm Grace Tlake, member of this committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Gigi Khwetla, I'm a member of the committee.
Good afternoon. I'm from the Health Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Krista Levendale, researcher to the Portfolio Committee on Women, Children, Youth, and Persons with Disabilities.
I'm Dumel Stoll. I'm from Sound and Vision Unit. Good afternoon. I'm Sipho Machoba, Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Ministry for Women, Children, and Persons with Disabilities.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Benzaevs. I'm from the Heinrich Boll Foundation.
Good afternoon. My name is Malunga Lomichenis from Eyewitness News.
Good afternoon. My name is Kanye Sanyonja. I'm from Parliamentary Communication Services.
Good afternoon. I'm Zubair Rahim. I'm the researcher for the Portfolio Committee on Health.
Good day, I'm Mireille from the French Consulate.
Good day, my name is Nelson Obatan, I'm the committee secretary of the committee. Thanks.
Thank you, honorable members. Are we still not ready? Thank you. not wasting any time. We are going to give this opportunity to the minister to give us a presentation on the child survival and maternal health national strategic plan on HIV/AIDS and on programs and budgets that are related to women, children, and people with disability. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of committee, and thank you for this opportunity. Chairperson, I have tried my best to try and answer the question that you have put forward to the department, but it's going to be very difficult to sort of pick up some topics here and put them as individual standalone topics, because quite a lot of things are integrated. I'm just hoping that my presentation will sort of answer the questions as we go on picking them up, because some of the things you can't separate. For instance, the whole issue of child survival and maternal mortality and HIV/AIDS are very closely interlinked, because you don't find children living in one different country as are other people. So I'm trying to make a presentation that shows overall what's happening. And even in terms of the budget, it's difficult to say in the Department of Health, this is a budget for children only. This is a budget for youth. This is a budget for women, because quite a number of programs are intermarried. Now, I've not been able to put that, but I've been able to put sort of the programs that we are following. Johannes, which one? Do I do it here or here? Or this is just a point? Okay, fine. My starting point to make you understand, we are living in quite a very complex country in terms of disease patterns. And there have been lots of arguments about what's going on in the country. For instance, there are quite a number of people who accuse me of turning the department into an HIV/AIDS department. As Minister, every time you talk, it's HIV/AIDS. Are there no other diseases? What about the other conditions? And there are even people who, even inside the Department of Health, are sort of arrogant to HIV/AIDS activists, because they say they pretend as if this is the only problem the country is faced with. Now, in order to put these arguments to a rest, I just want to put this slide, Chairperson, which shows exactly what South Africa is going through. It's a summary of what you're experiencing every day, what's going on in South Africa, what's going on in health services, what is going on in our communities. Basically, this slide is a study which has been commissioned by Lancet. As you know, the Lancet is a very prestigious British medical journal. But they did not do the study. They commissioned it. The study was done by our own researchers here in South Africa, professors and other researchers. Basically, what it says is that the country is going through four pandemics at the same time. In other words, we're going through four major disease patterns, which if we are not able to resolve, the whole situation of health in the country will not improve. The first pandemic, which is the one which I said I'm being accused of, is the pandemic of HIV/AIDS and TB. In short, it says while we are only 0.7% of the world population, but we contribute to 17% of HIV-positive people of the world. We contribute only 0.7% to world population, but we are carrying 17% of the HIV/AIDS. Our HIV/AIDS burden is 23 times that the global average. That is the first major pandemic, which if this country doesn't solve, lots of things don't become solvable. And I'm saying so because people cannot marry this to mortalities they see. When they hear that, you know, this overcrowding hospitals, so many children have died, they take them as events that are isolated from the major problem that the country is faced with. Whereas it's part and parcel of the same process Only that maybe they don't notice that. For instance, some of the slides I'm going to show you, I showed them to the media after the president addressed the NCOP in the watershed address about HIV AIDS in the country. I showed them statistics and what's going on. But later on, when things start happening, you realize that these people either did not hear you or are not aware that these are related things. So it's very important for people to understand that if you have got this, life won't be the same in your country. It's not just numbers. The 0.7% and 17%, they affect everyday events in your country, in education, in employment, in mortality, in hospitals. This is not just a number. I want to emphasize that. The second problem that we are going through, which is also classified as a pandemic, which is very unfortunate, is maternal, newborn, and child health. In short, maternal, newborn, and children's mortality. We've got very high mortalities here, which is not in keeping with the level of development of the country. In other words, the number of women who die in pregnancy, the number of children who die before they reach 1 year, and the number of children who die before they reach 5 years, you know, a newborn is infant, is below 1 year of age. Children, we describe it as 5 years or below. These mortalities are abnormal. They are not in keeping with our level of development, and they come as a result of the abnormalities the country is going through, but they've reached pandemic proportion. And when you see bits of them are appearing from hospitals, I mean in hospitals, in newspapers, etc., it's part and part of the same pattern of the pandemic, which needs to be resolved. The third major pandemic we are going through is that of non-communicable diseases. This is new in sub-Saharan Africa, especially among African populations. African populations used to suffer communicable diseases, that means infections. Non-communicable diseases like high blood pressure, diabetes mellitus, heart diseases were not diseases of the African people, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. It is now happening, and it's called an epidemiological transition. It's a shift. Now, this shift is happening in sub-Saharan Africa. In South Africa, there's no shift, unfortunately. It's an add-on. We are just adding on the problems that were there instead of shifting to new ones. But what it means is diabetes mellitus, high blood pressure, chronic heart diseases, chronic obstructive airway diseases, the cancers are on the increase. And they are driven by, because the communicable diseases like HIV, AIDS, TB, meningitis, pneumonia, are driven by organisms or what is commonly called germs. What is the germ here? The germ here is the human being here. There's no organism which can kill. It's the human being which is causing this. Because these diseases are driven by four major factors, or what you call risk factors. Smoking, alcohol, lack of exercise, diet. That's why I'm saying it's the human being which is causing these problems. And I'll come back to them much later, but this is increasingly becoming a problem. So much of a problem that in November this year, a decision has been taken by many international organizations that this must go to United Nations, to heads of state, to be included as part of Millennium Development Goals. Because in fact, in Millennium Development Goals, we only talk about maternal, newborn, maternal and child mortality, as well as HIV, AIDS, and TB. But we want to include this. The campaigns here will include the campaign that the government said we need to start, that of combating alcohol abuse, because the issue of smoking that we have already dealt with. These type of campaigns become more important in provinces like Western Cape and Northern Cape, where the level of, for instance, fetal alcohol syndrome is regarded to be the highest in the whole world. The last one, the last pandemic, is that of violence and injury. Everybody knows South Africa for this. When people were told not to come to World Cup, they were told to run away from this, not these others. But this is just a problem that we are faced with. So any program that we come up with in the department, we cannot divorce this things. That's why I cannot separate some of the things we're asking for. We have to take them together. Now, let me start with this pandemic to try and unpack it so as to understand what is the effect of this or what's going on. This, that means I'm taking this one now, the TB, HIV, AIDS, and TB. I have just started in 1990 among antenatal women. That means women who are pregnant who attend our antenatal clinics. Chairperson, I must warn that the only or the most trusted study for prevalence of HIV is that which we get from pregnant women, unfortunately. There's no other reliable. The most reliable studies about pregnant women, we cannot get reliable studies from men because we can't get them most of the time. The women who are pregnant, there's no way they can escape us because they attend our clinics. They are the ones who tell us how the prevalence of HIV AIDS is. That's why most of the time I'll keep on I'll keep on quoting women. Don't be surprised when I'm doing so. Because quite a number of men have not even tested in their lifetime. And that's the problem that we're also faced with. So what I'm trying to show is how did this pandemic affect the country and how did it happen that we come to where we are. It just started by 1990. That in 1990, among pregnant women who attended antenatal clinics in South Africa, the prevalence was 0.7%. It just kept on rising until in a period of about 18 years, it's now at 23.9%. Simply meaning that out of every three women who attend our antenatal clinic, at least one was found to be positive. That's where we are at the moment, within that period of 18 years. I also want to show prevalence by province, because whether you do a city campaign or you go to antenatal women, or you go to people between the age of 15 and 49, it will show you the same pattern, that the biggest problem of HIV AIDS in the country is in KZN, followed by Mpumalanga, followed by Free State. That the province which has got the least problem of HIV AIDS is Western Cape and Northern Cape, and to extent Limpopo, with Northwest, Gauteng, and Eastern Cape being the middle. But these three provinces are very problematic. It also shows that whether you go back to antenatal women, whether it's 2006, it's 2007 or 2008, three different years, you still find the same pattern. That KZN is number one, Mpumalanga is number two, Free State is number three. And also that the biggest, the most suffering is found in young women during childbearing years. This is where HIV is hitting the country the most. I wanted, especially members of parliament, because you go around in your constituency, to also understand where the areas of biggest problem are. So we are showing the districts of the country, province by province, from 2006, what has been happening. As you can see, the key there, that color there, the yellowish color, is the prevalence of between 20 and 30%, and that one is between 30 and 40%. The red color, which doesn't exist in the Eastern Cape, is prevalence of more than 40%, then you see it in red. Now, in the Eastern Cape, it shows that the districts that have got the prevalence of between 30 and 40% is the Nelson Mandela Metro and the O.R. Tambo district. They differ from year to year, but they more or less show the same pattern. And I must tell you that contrary to other socioeconomic indicators, we found the level of HIV is to be lower in the Eastern Cape. We did not expect this. I'll tell you later. People get angry when I say this. We did not expect this. It's showing us something that needs to make us think when you put strategies. I was expecting to be much higher, I must tell you, because of the socio-economic conditions. But I was surprised to find that it's lower. But now we believe we have got an answer why it's like that. This is Free State. You can see what I was talking about. It's number three. You can see areas which are between 30 and 40%. How many districts are there in the Free State? It is quite a big problem. This is Limpopo. It's my home province chairperson, as you know, I actually expected to be much higher. But as you can see, in districts like Vembe there, it's quite low. I did not expect this, and I'll again explain later, just like Eastern Cape, why Limpopo came as a surprise to me. This is Gauteng, as you can see, is quite a big problem, especially around the city of Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. In all the years where you check, this is a big problem. The worst problem is KZN, that's where the rates start to appear. All these district rates are having a prevalence of more than 40%, with Ngungundlovu being the highest at 45.7%, meaning that all pregnant women who were tested there in 2008, 45% of them were found to be positive. And as you can see in 2009, the number of districts in KZN, which are above 40%, have increased, with Uthukela there, in 2009, at 46.4%. I don't have studies for 2010 yet, because this study is done in October every year and released in August the following year. So the study for 2010 has just been done in October. It's still being analyzed, so I don't have the results of that we have got up to 2009. But you can see that whether it's 2006, 7, 8, or 9, KZN is, you know, it's a very big problem. This is Mpumalanga, which is number two. As you can see, consistently and persistently, two districts, Gertsi and then Mpumalanga, is quite problematic. But you can see the whole of Mpumalanga is also very problematic, and that's why it's number two in the country. This is Northern Cape. I told you it's much better. You can see that for yourself. This is Northwest, which is number four. You can see, especially around the mining areas, whether it's 2006, 7, 8, persistently around the mining areas of Budyanhara and Kenneth Kaunda, there is a problem there. And this is Western Cape. I told you is the least problem of HIV AIDS. That map speaks for itself. In conclusion, Chairperson, the HIV AIDS, this is from 2008 study, among pregnant women is at 29.3%. Out of the 52 districts in the country, about four districts were above 40% in that study of 2009. I didn't summarize the others. And 70 districts were between 30 and 40, with six of them in KZN, as you can see, and 19 districts recording between 20 and 30. It means out of 52 districts in South Africa, 40 districts are between 20 and 30% prevalence or above. And only 12 districts seems to be much lower and mostly found in the Western Cape. This was just showing young people that 31% of the population, those who are under 15 years, or 15.48 million people are below the age of 15, and that 40% of them are found in KZN, that is 23 plus 17. We're just showing this slide to project if all these young people become positive following the trend in their provinces, what will happen to the country. Life expectancy as a result of this has dramatically reduced in South Africa. I'm just comparing South Africa with three African countries, Algeria, Senegal, and us. As you can see, we are the lowest in life expectancy. And Chairperson, I'm afraid I'm in that age group. And it means in terms of this life, I must start thinking about what's going to happen to me. Yes, that's the unfortunate part of it. If you compare us with a country like Cuba, where life expectancy is now 78 years, it means an average Cuban lives 28 years more than an average South African in terms of this. So life expectancy has tremendously gone down in the country. In fact, it is believed that if nothing drastic is done, by 2015 our life expectancy will have moved back by 55 years, will be where it was in 1955. Despite technological and economic advancement. State South Africa will show you in terms of mortality. I'm showing this because it's important for the economy. That in 2006, out of every 10 South Africans who died, 6 are below the age of 50, meaning that these are your economically active population. It simply means, Chairperson, that we are busy creating a society of the elderly. where the young ones are going. You just have to see the practicality of this when you do house-to-house campaign, which I did with the deputy president in Khertsib and then Mpumalanga, where you saw his rate. You get into a family, you find a granny with 8 or 10 kids, all below the age of 10. They belong to 3 different mothers who were daughters to that granny. They are all dead and they are left with the granny. So either the family is child-headed or is granny-headed. And that incidence is increasing in South Africa, unfortunately. When we sit and see them as figures, we believe they end up here in Parliament. They go right there in communities where people are living, and you start seeing them practically. It's the result of this. The 50 people who are younger than 50 are teachers, doctors, policemen, accountants, nurses. They are the people who are running the country, and they are living grannies. Many grannies, I must tell you, have been now being forced to get out of grandmotherhood back into motherhood. That's the reality of the situation in South Africa. When did this thing happen? When did this massive shift, which put us in this place, when did it start taking place? I'm showing that slide. It actually shows that it took place within a period of 8 years. In other words, it was swift. And that slide shows it. It looks very busy, but I'll show you. Oh, by the way, I'm pointing there and some people are looking this side. I don't know how to help in that here. Yeah. You see, this graph shows 1997. From the age of zero to 4 years there until 85 years or greater than 85 years. How were people dying? What it shows is that the majority of people are dying here, which is about 60 years or there, which is 70 years, which is normal. That's how the wealth has always been and how we understand it. But bit by bit, between 1997 and 2005, a major shift took place in South Africa. It kept on shifting to younger people until by 2005, more deaths were occurring there. That is that red graph. As you can see, it's at 30 years. That's where most people were dying, living these grannies here. Now, it's significant that such a shift could take place within a period of 8 years, meaning something drastic happened in a country. But that's the reality of what we faced with now. This is among showing that while this shift is for the whole population, but the heaviest brand is carried by young women. We're comparing a country more or less at the same level of development with us, which is Brazil. In 2004, this was how people were dying, women, not people, females were dying in Brazil. From the age of 15 to 60, which is very normal, as you know. It's very normal. In 1997 in South Africa, we were more or less normal, but we were starting to show some signs of wobbling, you know. And swiftly by 2004, everything had changed. Most young women in South Africa are dying at that age now. Now, significantly, Professor Malega Puru Makhoba, who is the principal or vice chancellor of University of Natal, when he was the president of the Medical Research Council, MRC, he wrote in the journal in 2001 that something is killing young women in South Africa at childbearing age, which is not in keeping with laws of biology. And that statement was just ignored. I mean, it's just a statement. Nobody thought much about it. But he was saying something is happening in your country which is abnormal. When he said, it's not keeping with the laws of biology, it means that in biology this doesn't happen. What does that mean? If you go to all species, all living species in the animal kingdom, you can start with butterfly and up with elephants. You won't find this graph. You'll find that one. Because normally people die when they are older, not when they are younger. But secondly, the female species is supposed to outlive the male species, as you see with life expectancy. But in South Africa, that is starting to change. We are having many more women dying at younger the age than men. That's completely unbiological. There's no law of biology in the universe that is keeping with that. But the HIV/AIDS has come to distort it. When Makhoba wrote that statement, he never mentioned HIV/AIDS. He just mentioned that these people are dying in large numbers. And he never said because of this cause. But we know now what was actually causing that. TB. A disease which we thought we have largely defeated, which we thought was long gone, which has got immunization, which has got treatment, which when I was born was being treated. It's certainly a major problem in South Africa. What I'm showing you here, which is not very clearly visible because it's a small slide, but I'll explain. It shows 22 countries in the world. These 22 countries are carrying 80% of the TB of the world. As you can see there, number one is India, followed by China, Indonesia, Nigeria. South Africa is number five in terms of the number of people who have got TB. We're number five in the world, but this is misleading for the simple reason that China has got 30 times our population and India has got 30 times our population. So in terms of the number of people, there have to be more. So the correct measure is to check how many people are infected per population. And this is measured per 100,000 people. How many people have got this TB out of every 100,000? If you do that, the truth comes out. South Africa becomes number one in the whole world at 948 people infected per 100,000 population. That's number one. As you can see, our distance number two there is Zimbabwe. The other countries start falling behind. The second measure, which is worry, so TB is a major problem in the country. In fact, 80% of HIV-positive people in South Africa are killed by TB. 80%. That's the disease that kills them now. The second measure that is worrying is co-infection rate, meaning how many people are sharing both TB and HIV, or how many people who you think have got TB are actually HIV positive. In India, it is 5.3%, in China, 1.9%, in Indonesia, 3%, in Nigeria, 27%, in South Africa, it is 73%. As you can see, it's the highest, and our distance number two again in Zimbabwe, meaning in South Africa, TB and HIV/AIDS tend to be two sides of the same coin. In more than 70% of the population, it means the same thing, just presenting separately. And so it means when you treat them, you must regard them as one thing. That's why we told SANAC in their national strategic plan, which is about HIV, that SANAC must now become an HIV and TB mobilizing group. You can't deal with HIV away from TB in South Africa. You can afford to do so in China or India, but in South Africa it will be wasting time. It must be regarded as the same. That's why this is very important. DALA means daily life adjusted, life adjusted life years. Daily adjusted life years, I mean to say. In simple language, it means what keeps South Africans away from work, away from school, away from normal activities because they are sick. Many people will believe it's violence and injury or traffic accidents, which everybody reports about. Our study shows that 30% of people, 30.9%, are away from work or school from any normal activity because of HIV. And 3.7% are away because of TB. When you add them, it's 34.6%, most close to 35%. Interpersonal violence and injury will only keep 6.75% of South Africans away, and road traffic accident only 3% away. The major cause of absenteeism in all social activities and economic activities is by far HIV, AIDS, and TB in South Africa. Among pregnant women, this shows that HIV, this slide shows this, that let me tell you how we obtained this study. These were studies of files of women who died in pregnancy. If you have to study in both private and public hospitals, what killed them? It was found that among women who were negative, 34 out of 100,000 will die in pregnancy. But among those who are positive, 328 out of 100,000, meaning HIV/AIDS increases maternal mortality tenfold. It explains why South Africa has got such a high maternal mortality all of a sudden. HIV/AIDS increases 10 times. Among women who died untested is 275 over 100,000. It simply tells you, if you compare that, that these women did not test, but mostly they were positive. Only that they died untested. So HIV/AIDS is one of the major drivers of maternal mortality. In terms of our studies, it contributes 43% to maternal mortality. Remember, maternal mortality is not death of a woman. It's death of a woman because she's pregnant. and she's killed by something that related to her pregnancy. If she dies of a gunshot wound or a car accident, that is not maternal mortality. It must be related to the pregnancy. This is also a summary of mortality in South Africa, Chairperson. In terms of our files, 1,600 women die in pregnancy every year. But the studies show that the figure is actually 4,000. That's what the World Health Organization believes, because these are files inside hospitals. A lot of them die outside hospitals. And in terms of the World Health Organization, this figure must be 4,000. But we are using it because it's not a study at the files we have got. It also shows that annually, 20,000 babies are born dead. That's still bad, 20,000. And annually, the number of children who die before they reach 1 year are 22,000. I was asked a question here by a member of parliament, how many children died in the first 5 years of last year? And I responded 8,000. There was a big uproar as if it's a new finding. There were 5,000 because it was up to April, but per annum is 22,000. This is a spectrum, Chairperson, you can understand it. If you have got 20,000 still deaths, that means these children cannot even be born, they die. It means some of them do get born today and die tomorrow. And it means quite a number of them, which is now happening in the hospital, are born below weight age. We are now seeing children born at 600 grams, 800 grams, if you like, 1 kilogram. A normal child must be born at 2.5 kilogram to 3.5. That's a normal birth weight. But increasingly, they come earlier. Why? The stillbirth is also driven by HIV. The significance of this is to answer a question that you already asked me. It causes overcrowding in hospitals because you can't send them home. Normally, a woman delivers. If it's a normal pregnancy, we check it. The following day, she goes home. But you can't send them home with a birth weight of 800 or 1 kilogram. So they cause overcrowding in our hospital, especially around Gauteng. If you check the area around Kurulane, when I showed you those maps, the overcrowding is just getting out of hand. Where, you know, our neonatal unit with a certain number of incubators can no longer cope because we need to have more babies in incubators. That is the strategy we are faced with. Now, the other strategy is children who die before they reach the age of 5. It is now 75,000 per annum in South Africa. This study showing prevalence by sex, I thought it's important for members of parliament to understand this slide. That color there, female, that one being male. It shows that early on in life, there are more males who are HIV positive than females. But when sexual activity starts, the females start jumping up now. As you can see, these are females. And later on in life, the males take over, meaning that young women suffer the brunt more than young men. And there's only one simple explanation, is sugar daddyism. Yes, it shows that older men are having sex with young girls, infecting them very early on in life. From that belief that you sleep with a virgin, etc., and it's making... I'm sure you saw the headlines of the Star over the past 2 days. One school having 57 young pregnant girls from the age of 15 to the age of 13 to 15. This is what you see in there. Because when people read that these kids are pregnant in that school in Limpopo, 57 in one school, when you read that, what people don't put in mind is that it means they slept with each other without condoms. It's not only pregnancy, it's HIV. That's going to come. It explains most of this slide, why it's young women who are suffering. It's also HIV because it means it's unprotected sex. And the Minister of Basic Education has told me that the anecdote, because this has not yet studied, but you see by anecdote, I was happy that also in the study picked it. Most of those girls are actually orphans. It becomes a vicious cycle. There are orphans of HIV AIDS coming from families which are child-headed or granny-headed. They easily fall prey for men who come with money because they are poor, and then sleep with them, they fall pregnant, it becomes a vicious cycle. So if your parents die of HIV AIDS, you are likely to die of HIV AIDS. That's the simple conclusion that we are reaching. And then HIV AIDS among the babies. This is the stats from South Africa. It shows that in 2007, that 75,000 young people who I say they die before the age of five, it shows that in 2007, 57% of them were killed by HIV/AIDS, meaning the HIV/AIDS is the biggest killer even among children younger than five. The second thing it shows that when a baby is born HIV positive, that child stands 15 times more likely to die within the first 6 months of life. Differently put, HIV/AIDS increases the likelihood of babies to die in the first 6 months by 1,500%. Considering that in South Africa, let me put the African continent, or let me compare it with Europe. Let me choose one country, friends. In 2009, four women transmitted HIV/AIDS to their children, meaning only four babies were born HIV positive in France. In the continent of Africa, that figure is 400,000. 400,000 children were born HIV positive in Africa in 2009. And 70,000 of those come from South Africa. We contribute 70,000 of those. So out of those 70,000 children who are born HIV positive, they are 15 times more likely to die in the first 6 months. In other words, their death rate increases 1,500% over those who are negative. This just compares two provinces about whether when you act, whether there's a change or not. I compared Mpumalanga and Western Cape because it's very easy to compare the two because they've had huge contrast on this. In 1998, how were children dying in Mpumalanga between the ages of 0 months to 11 months? That means before the first 12 months of life. This was the graph. It was almost at the bottom in 1998. Very swiftly, within 8 years, in keeping with the first graph, the figure jumped to that. And it's in the first 3 months. Within that period of 8 years, that's where most babies are dying in Mpumalanga. You now move to Western Cape. In 2008, Western Cape was much worse than Mpumalanga. That was their graph. Remember, the Mpumalanga one was here. It reached a peak in 2003. In 2003, the Western Cape started a massive dual therapy of prevention of mother-child transmission. And by 2006, the results were showing the number of children dying early on were falling to that. Had fallen to that. Meaning that when action is taken drastically, things will happen, as Western Cape did in 2003. This I'm just showing members of parliament because, as I'm saying, you see these things as figures, or you go out in community, you see other things, you don't know how they relate. Every year, the Independent Electoral Commission will take the voters' roll and compare it with the death register in Home Affairs. And between 1 September 2008 and 31st August 2009, within a period of 12 months, when they compared the death register in Home Affairs and the voters' roll, this number of people fell off the voters' roll. It then came 60,000, 15,000, 32,000, and that's the total number. They never said it's HIV/AIDS. I'm just putting a question mark. Why so many people are falling off the voters' roll? They are falling off because they are dead, by the way. Yes. This shows the doubling of death rate in South Africa. In other words, things were not always like this. Death actually doubled in a period of 9 years. In 1997, the death register of the country was that. 317,000 people were dying in South Africa per annum. But by 2006, the figure had doubled to 612,000, and it's increasing. And that happened between that year and that year, as you can see, is a doubling of death in 9 years. Youth and adolescents, I just picked up a few slides to try and demonstrate to you that the younger you are in terms of maternal mortality, the younger you are, the more likely you are to die in pregnancy. In other words, teenage mothers die much easier than older mothers, which means the headline of the Star about those girls between the ages of 13 and 15 who are already pregnant, the chance of dying because of pregnancy-related complications is very high. And I'm just taking one of them, hypertension. Hypertension in pregnancy is a big killer of pregnant women, but it kills the younger ones more than the older ones, as you can see. Below the age of 20, that's that. In 2024 is the highest, followed by 25 to 29. When they get older, 35 to 39, it drops. So most deaths among those less than 25 years are due to eclampsia. It's a complication of pregnancy-induced hypertension, meaning that the acceleration of going to antenatal clinic must be increased. And because most of them are schoolgirls, they are hiding it. They don't go to the clinic. So you don't pick up any that they've got high blood pressure. They come with complications. They die, increasing our mortality. That shows also HIV. For some reason, it shows also that the younger you are, the more likely you are to die of HIV/AIDS in pregnancy. As you can see, in that age group, that's where most of the deaths are. When they get older, it actually reduces. This shows parity. Parity is the number of children we have got. Is there a relationship? Yes, because somebody was asking this. Does this issue of teenage pregnancy contribute to maternal death? It definitely does. All these slides are showing that. Those who have got no child falling pregnant for the first time, that was the death. Those with one child, that is it. Those with two, as you can see, those with five children, the likelihood of dying is only 0.9%. But those who are still young, 28%, 31%, 22%, as you can see, it's a very huge figure. So the mortalities are not only for older women. They are actually going to much younger women. The other problem, Chairperson, young women in South Africa are using abortion as contraception. They're no longer going to family planning. They are not taking contraceptive pills. They are no longer trying to control pregnancy. They control it by committing abortion. And it's quite unfortunate, because it means somewhere primary health care is lacking contraceptive services. But this problem is not only in South Africa. It's sub-Saharan Africa. In 2009, there was an international conference of gynecologists here in Cape Town, where all the gynecologists of the world gathered. I was called in that conference by the United Nations Population Development, who brought concerns to me that in sub-Saharan Africa, since sub-Saharan Africa started fighting against HIV/AIDS, they've thrown contraception out of the window. We concentrated on fighting HIV/AIDS and forgot. Many women will no longer remember the last time they heard about the contraceptive pill. And they said this problem needs to be resolved. Now, this problem has produced this. Since the termination of pregnancy act in 1997, 702,354 young people committed abortion. That's the figure. It was the highest in 2006. As you can see, it shows age. Those below the age of 18, this figure. Those above the age of 18, those of unknown age, and that is the total. And the highest, as you can see, it kept on increasing until in 2006 it reached a peak. It is now going a little bit down. We don't know whether it's decreasing or not, but we suspect it's because quite a number of institutions are just overwhelmed. They are no longer doing it. Meaning somebody then said no. Minister, you must increase the number of centers where termination of pregnancy is committed. I said, no. It's like telling me that please increase the number of mortuaries because many more people are dying. You go and check what kills the people and stop it. What is making these young kids commit abortions? It means there's no family planning, or they are not practicing it, or they've forgotten about it. Despite the fact that we are distributing condoms, they are ignoring them. This shows it. It actually shows that in the Western Cape, contraception is much better. It shows couple year protection. It means contraceptive services. What is the uptake? As you can see, we are targeting there. Look where we still are. With the Western Cape, not reaching the target, but much better in terms of contraceptives. In other words, it means our plan on women reproductive health rights need to become a major campaign. And I'm hoping the committee will realize that that's your sphere of work. in women, youth, and people with disabilities. The other problem in the country is PHC utilization. This is very important, members. Primary health care utilization rate. We have reached a situation in South Africa, and that also causes overcrowding, that people wake up from home and go to tertiary services. This is not how health care must be conducted. You don't just wake up and go to the highest hospital. You start at clinics, because some people only have minor ailments. I discovered this anecdotally, and now I'm seeing it in actual studies there. During the strike when I worked at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, that evening when I spent the night there, I was shocked, because I realized that most of the people who come there are not supposed to be there. They just wake up. I mean, Baragwanath Hospital is a teacher hospital, it's a teaching hospital. It's one of the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere. Don't just wake up from home and go there. And when I asked, I found that it's actually like that. And that causes overcrowding in the ward. It causes congestion in the casualty. It causes the nurses to have their nerves freeing up, and the doctors angry most of the time because they can't deal with the crowd. What does it mean? It means people are not utilizing clinics. Either it is us who are not making them utilize them, or something is happening in the community that needs to be drastically changed. In my 10-point program, in the 10-point program in health, we said it's overhauling. We need to overhaul the whole healthcare service and move it towards primary healthcare, because some people need to be treated at clinics. And one of the ways is actually to take the doctors out of the hospital and put some of them in the clinics. That's one of the plans that we are putting forth, because that will be important for people to know that even if I go to a clinic, maybe once a week I'll see the doctor. Otherwise, they'll just go and crowd in the hospital. And it becomes a vicious cycle. The more they crowd, the more mortalities, the more congestion, and we just keep on failing. Now, it explains that the rate of at which primary health cases are utilized by the catchment population, represented as the average number of visits per person per year in the catchment population. The denominator is usually census-driven population estimates. But basically, in short, people in South Africa are not utilizing clinics. They utilize tertiary hospitals. And that's not normal anywhere in the world. Actually, I was very disturbed when I was addressing traditional leaders. One of them stood up after I addressed them. He said, "Minister, your nurses are forcing us to go to clinics, and you must consult us. We don't want to go to clinics, we want to go to hospitals." I got very scared. That type of health care doesn't survive anyway. In fact, one of the reasons that health care is so expensive in South Africa is because of that. Primary health care does not actually even mean clinic. And this issue is not a new debate. It was defined by the World Health Organization in the World Health Assembly in September 1978 in Alma Ata, where they defined health afresh. They gave health a new definition. They said health is not just the absence of disease or infirmity, but it's a state of good physical, social, and mental well-being. It means there must be housing, roads, education, free running water, etc. Primary health care right from the communities even before people get ill. So this defines the South African healthcare system, this which I've mentioned many times. I said our health system is characterized by four things. It's unsustainable, very unsustainable. It is extremely expensive. It's curative. And it's hospice-centric, around hospitals. And healthcare service is not supposed to be around hospitals. That should be the last port of call. And what is worse, it's not ordinary hospitals. At the last, the hospitals that are supposed to be referral services. So in South Africa, that trend needs to be reversed if we have to deal with these mortalities. In the mind of the population, like I'm mentioning 70,000 children who are born HIV positive, how do you stop that? People believe you'll stop it by doctors and nurses working harder to make a child who's 600 grams live. Not going to happen, but they believe so. If it doesn't happen, it's an attack. How will you stop it? By making sure that the 70,000 children born HIV positive do not exist. How do you do that? Make sure that every woman who's pregnant goes to test, and if it's positive, start treatment early, which is now 14 weeks. Then that child will survive. To believe that that child is going to survive in a hospital, which is what everybody else thinks, That is the overall mentality now, that hospitals must do miracles. That the actual treatment, as the World Health Assembly has declared in Alma Ata, must start in the communities and move upwards and only arrive at the hospital where we failed. That has actually evaded the minds of South Africans. We need to change that type of mentality. We need to turn the health situation around. And our plans is actually doing that. In other words, we need to launch a massive primary healthcare campaign in South Africa. Stop things from happening. It's not rocket science. Even when we were young, before we went to school, in my language, Varitivela Maluji Palakalaf, prevention is better than cure. That's my language, that's primary healthcare. But in South Africa, they all put emphasis at cure, and if it fails there, they say everybody else is failing. And people even start to believe that prevention is always better than cure, and prevention starts in communities. It doesn't start in the hospital. This is PAT supervision. How many, and maybe before I pass, Chairperson, if you look at this slide of primary territorialization, the West province is Gauteng. And it's understandable why. That is the center of cure. That's where you've got all the private hospitals and big hospitals. And so people have forgotten. If you read the papers and listen all the time, around Gauteng, when they talk about health, they talk about Chris Hani Karabanak Hospital, Charlotte Maseke, Steve Biko, and then George Mukari. If they've got time, you will add Natal's Creed, etc. These are the four major tertiary hospitals. Nothing else is mentioned. No clinic, no smaller hospital, no secondary. It's up there on top, and it shows there. That Gauteng has believed their health care will be solved in this tertiary hospital. It can't work. It has never worked anywhere in the world. In fact, you know, in Britain, in terms of their national health service, nobody goes to a hospital unless referred by a GP at primary health care level. Otherwise, they'll turn you back home. But in South Africa, if we turn anybody, it will be headlines that people are being turned away and all that. But that's how countries manage their healthcare service. So we need to move together to change that situation. Supervision means, are there senior people who go to this institution? And there are very few. So one of the things I'm going to do in the next 6 months, Chairperson, is to appoint four people in each district, which I think are key to deal with this issue of primary health care, maternal mortality, and infant mortality to meet our Millennium Development Goals. We need to have a senior district gynecologist in every district, a person who is a specialist in gynecology, who sits there in the district to make sure that all things happen in gynecology. Mothers who are pregnant attend family planning, including even the school girls. Mothers who are pregnant and HIV positive start PMTCT at 14 months of pregnancy. You know, we need that gynecologist. The second person we need to have at HIV is a senior pediatrician, a pediatric specialist. This number of children who are dying before they reach the age of 75, we need somebody to take care of them. The third will be a midwife. We need a person called the district midwife, who understand the issue of pregnancy and childbirth. And lastly, we need a primary health care in the district to reverse this trend of people believing they must just wake up and drive to the nearest hospital. That's what one of the strategies that we need, and which we believe in the next 6 months, we must have got such people. They must start work and become responsible for this work. Otherwise, where I'm sitting, you discover a problem when somebody is dead already. It's then that you know there was a problem. There must be somebody who stops it before it happens. Chairperson, that is broadly what South Africa is all about. Now, how do we deal with this situation? I hope this time the technology moves faster, Chairperson. I always get surprised. In my understanding, I don't know whether it's an anecdote. These technologies work when you are in the office, but when you start seeing many people, it just gets scared and stage fright, you know. Because I was in the office the whole morning looking at this slide, but when I came here, we had to wait for about 20 minutes before anything could happen. So, Chairperson, while they are opening, clearly from what I said, apart from many other strategies, you can see from what I presented that the biggest strategy ever that South Africa must adopt is to deal with HIV/AIDS. All other things, even the non-communicable disease, which people said, no, but Minister, what about diabetes? What about cancer? They are also driven by HIV/AIDS, apart from the others. Why am I saying so? It's a well-known fact that women who are HIV positive easily develop cervical cancer, cancer of the cervix, of the womb. In fact, in one hospital, Helen Joseph in Gauteng, where 10% of all HIV-positive people are treated, they have done pap smear there, and they've got 50% positive, meaning 50% of the women who are HIV-positive are already showing signs of developing cancer of the womb, which means if the HIV-AIDS doesn't get to them or TB doesn't get to them, they are surely going to die of cancer of the womb. It's on the increase. But secondly, other cancers which disappeared long ago, which some of us have only read in textbooks, they are back because of HIV/AIDS. A case in point is what they call Kaposi sarcoma. Even leprosy, many of you have read about leprosy in the Bible. It is back now. We see about 70 cases per annum in South Africa. Except that the leprosy in the Bible where your fingers are falling off is because there are no medical care. So the one now you won't see it because people's fingers are not falling off. But when you diagnose, you check them, you discover that they actually have leprosy, which we thought was gone, is back. So many things which we thought have disappeared are coming back on the back of HIV and AIDS. So our plan to deal with HIV/AIDS, you said here in your letter that I must deal with the National Strategic Plan on HIV/AIDS. The National Strategic Plan, in short, in summary, has got two main objectives: that will reduce the rate of infection by 50% by 2011, and number two, 80% of people that need treatment to be provided with antiretroviral treatment. I'm worried, Chairperson. This National Strategic Plan was adopted in 2007 up to 2011, but in essence, South Africa adopted this but did nothing. In short, we adopted this and hope it will happen. Take, for instance, the testing. We adopted this, but say voluntary counsel and testing. That means those who know can go and test. And many did not necessarily go. And the treatment, that only a few hospitals are allowed to treat. But we want to reach this objective. That was not going to happen. So, as you are aware, we decided that in order for this national strategic plan, the goals to be achieved, something drastic must happen. You don't put goals and fold your arms and life becomes normal. When you put goals, you put something drastic to make sure that you meet those goals. That is the failure which I see the country actually experienced. And that's why 2011 is around the corner. We are now going to review the strategic plan for the next 5 years. But the World AIDS Day, the president was trying to turn the corner on World AIDS Day in December 2009, but it was already 2 years after the adoption of the strategic plan. What simply the president did was two major announcements. He mentioned new treatment regimens, but also mentioned, this is wrongly written. Yes, this is not supposed to be. The bullet points are wrongly written because I just wanted to show that there were two major announcements. The first one, they were just written the same, but this is supposed to be a heading. The major announcement, my president, the first one is the new treatment regimen. He said, let's put up new treatment plans in order to reach that 80% of the people. And this was announced in December 2009. Number one, that all pregnant women, you saw how they are dying, the mortality. Let's not wait until the CD4 count is 250 as we were doing in the past. Let's treat them, it's 200. Let's treat them when it's 350. This, we believe, after 1 year is going to show major gains. But we only started in April. It's not even a year that we've implemented this. Because we started in April last year, the implementation. It will only be a year in April this year. We'll go back and see how many women have we saved by treating them when the CD4 count is 350. I'm eagerly waiting for April to see if there's a change. The second area, you saw the co-infection rate, the highest in the world. People have got TB and HIV. Don't wait until the CD4 count is 200. start treating them when it's 350. We also started in April. We want to see whether there will be a difference in the death rate between people, among people who are co-infected after 1 year of starting treatment earlier. The third is all pregnant women not on treatment to start PMTC at 14 weeks. Previously, prevention of mother-to-child transmission was at 28 weeks. Because of the 70,000 children who are born HIV positive, from April last year, we are now starting at 14 weeks. I'm repeating, Chairperson, it will be extremely good for South Africa if every pregnant woman can know this and go to hospital before 14 weeks. Most of them, as you know, in far rural areas, they come in the hospital to deliver. It's no miracle you can do there. They come in the hospital to deliver, or they come to register to deliver. They usually come when they realize they are about 30 weeks or so, then they come and register in the nearest clinic, so that when they come to deliver, the nurse must not be surprised. That is too late. You can only fight HIV AIDS, and as I'm saying, it then means that it's not the hospital who can win that battle. It's us in communities, because we are the ones who know which woman is pregnant. That's why I was talking to traditional leaders. I was talking to ministers of religion, that everybody must take responsibility. I'm speaking to members of parliament. In your constituency, councillors, in their wards, how many women do they know who are pregnant there? In our rights cultured society, our culture of rights, they might say, now this is private matter. Why, minister, are you going to be chasing a pregnant woman and asking them if they are pregnant? They've tested. The question, the problem is people are dying. It's a fact. And the 70,000 will keep on increasing. And I want to tell people, I got worried. Or maybe let me finish it before I show my worry. The president then also said all HIV-positive infants must start treatment regardless of CD4 count. Immediately you diagnose a child below the age of one, start treatment. Now my worry. If we don't increase prevention of mother-child transmission, we resort to treating these 70,000 children. You are starting treatment before you are age of one. If you are going to live up to 60 years, you must drink tablets every day for the whole 60 years of your life. That is not good life, Chairperson. Showing again that prevention is better than cure. You're not going to help this child by putting them on ARVs for the rest of their lives. It's something that we need to be avoiding. But when we do it, it is because we failed to do this PMTCT. And in terms of our outputs, we think in the next 5 years, if we work very hard as a country, not only as a department, we ought to have less than 7% of children born HIV positive. The ideal figure is obviously 0%. But I'm just saying at least less than 5%. That's an acceptable percentage that we need to be targeting as a country. Now, the president then mentioned prevention. I got worried because people picked up the first one, treatment, and say, oh, at last, South Africa is now coming to its senses. Because we once thought about treatment, said now the president of the country is announcing it means things are going to be right. People never looked at the prevention part. That was a major announcement which I want to be in the minds of people. Prevention, prevention, and prevention. Now, we have adopted 9 prevention strategies, not only one. When we started the HCT campaign, or when you talk about condoms, people believe that's the only strategy. There are 9 strategies of preventing HIV/AIDS in South Africa, which must all be implemented. The first one is information, education, mass mobilization. We are not yet doing well here. We are putting up plans. When you move around South Africa, you don't find information about HIV/AIDS, about HIV education. You find small boards at corners written abortion this side, or penis enlargement that side, or strong erection this side. That's what characterizes the country. It worries me. It sounds like madness, but you meet these people everywhere where you're going. And you start wondering, what type of country? Why are people thinking like that in the face of all these problems? But those are the boards you see. I want to see the boards about information, education to young people, even in schools. And in this case, Chairperson, apart from primary health care, I'm going to come to it. Myself and the Minister of Education must launch urgently a school health program. We must start nurses going there to schools. to stop this type of things that you see. So information, education, mass mobilization is key. And mass mobilization means everybody, not only health workers. It means politicians, it means leaders, church leaders, leaders, traditional leaders, everybody in society. Secondly, detection of sexually transmitted disease and management. You are aware that people who have got sexually transmitted disease, they easily get HIV/AIDS, so the sooner we treat them, the better. Thirdly, know your status. Chairperson, know your status. HIV counseling and testing. I was shocked in the past days that there's a debate about the Minister of Education having said, no, we want all the school kids to know their status. Lots of questions. We launched a campaign that 15 million people must know their status. How do you treat and help people if people don't know their status? In South Africa, we still want to keep it a secret. I have asked, and I won't stop asking. I have asked the speaker, I've spoken to the chief whip, I want to attend a chief whip meeting. Even members of parliament must know their status, because we're shooting in the dark. School chiefs must know their status. There are 12 million of them there. And people are raising questions. Look at what you are seeing, 57 of them pregnant in one school. They're sexually active. So it means their status must be known. Otherwise, how do we deal with this pandemic? When you don't know, you can't just keep on shooting in the dark and hoping we'll get the target somewhere. So this campaign to test 15 million people, it involves every South African, young and old. In fact, the children sector came to me and said, Minister, why do you say you want to start at the age of 12 years of... What about the babies? You saw in your statistics they are dying. Why can't they get tested? If mothers don't test and they give birth to these 70,000 kids, when are you going to know that this kid is positive? When they die? So they must all test. All ages. That's what South Africa must do. So what the debate should be, rather, how do you approach schools, because they are not like ordinary institutions, not like adults. You've got school kids there, not whether they must test or not, but how do you approach them? What is the mechanism of going to a school and say, let me know the status of this? It's sensitive, I know. So fortunately, the children's sector, SANAC, and the department, for the past 2 weeks, we've been sitting down to try and map up this thing together with the concerns of how is it going to be done. What mechanism, what are sensitive? Those who are found positive, what happens to them? Because we are going to find quite a number of school kids who are positive. When we launched the HCT campaign, we said 12 years and above. On the day the president launched, I saw many young kids less than 10 years on the queue there in Natal Street. And I went to them. I said, but you are young. They said, no, but we want to know our status. And I couldn't tell them that, no, go away. That 6 months later, KZN told us that parents were literate in KZN coming with their children and say, you are not going to test me alone. I want to know the state of my child. And within 6 months, they found 300 children who were positive, all below the age of 10. Nobody knew that before. Mothers are just suspecting. Why? Because they know the mother of this child died. They don't even know what killed them. But they suspect, and the child is not testing. The next moment, we see headlines about mortality and say, doctors are not working hard enough. They are killing our people, not realizing that something that's what already happened in society. So this issue of testing, take it very serious. Widespread provision of condoms, male and females. We are providing condoms, but we are not yet satisfied that they are widespread enough. And we want to try our best. In the budget, we are trying to increase the condoms at least 3 times. For instance, the female condoms, we are only providing 1 million. We want to provide 6 million. We got information, Chairperson, that women even go to an extent of washing the female condom to reuse it. In some of the female condoms around Gauteng, that has been discovered. Why? The female condom costs 8 rand. The male condom costs only 24 cents. So for females to go and buy without the state providing, it's a mammoth of a task. If they get one, they want to keep on using it, believing that they are safe, and we know they are not safe. So we want to increase the number sixfold, and if possible, to keep on increasing them, and increase the male condoms even more than that. Medical male circumcision. Earlier on, Chairperson, I made statements which people believe are controversial. When I showed the maps of where HIV/AIDS is most prevalent, I said I did not expect the situation to be that better in Western, in Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga. And I want to explain myself. I've been in government for 16 years. All the socio-economic indicators in South Africa, be it level of education, matric results, housing, employment, poverty levels, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and KZN will go like triplets. They will always do that. They will always go like triplets. That's where most of the problems are. And Western Cape will always be better. And there are historical reasons. The historical reasons are Eastern Cape has three bantu stands, two of which were independent, you know. Everybody knows what was happening in the bantu stands in terms of poverty and everything else. Limpopo had three bantu stands out of 10 in the country. KwaZulu-Natal had only one, but it was the biggest of them all. So those factors make their socioeconomic indicators to go together. The only socioeconomic indicator which separates them is HIV/AIDS. Yes, you saw. And it should not be happening. There must be something that caused that separation. KZN is the West. Instead of Eastern Cape and Limpopo also being the West because of they are always triplets, they suddenly differ. The only thing we can think about, because it has also been studied, is medical male circumcision. It has been proven that it reduces the rate of HIV transmission by between 50% and 60%. And we all know for 200 years, there was no traditional circumcision practice in KZN. We know for sure in Eastern Cape, circumcision is a religion. Every male must circumcise. In Limpopo, among the three tribal groups, they all practice traditional circumcision. Why is Mpumalanga number two? You check my map there. The red one is Khetsibanda. In Khetsibanda, they don't circumcise at all because mostly they are Zulu speaking in terms of that tradition. That's why KZN changed that tradition, and why they're happy the king announced it, because we showed him the map that this, the reason that you see this much red in KZN is to do with circumcision. And the king agreed and he launched the circumcision campaign, and it's been done medically. And we want this campaign to be all over the country. It's one of the most, the major prevention measures, not the only one. And I'm happy that KZN has taken a lead. They've taken a lead in most of these things because they realize they've got a problem, and I'm very proud of that. Leadership from the Premier, from the King, from MEC. I'm not saying other provinces are not giving leadership, but in KZN it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal because the King just called all Amakosi and said, we started this thing. We only started in April. Already 17,000 males have been circumcised, Chairperson. And we are targeting 2.5 million by 2015. We were pushing Mpumalanga to start, and they've launched somewhere in December last year, especially around Khetsibanda. It's an important campaign. And Chairperson, because I can also do that job, I've availed myself that in KZN, I'll do 1,000 in this period until 2015. I've only done 3, unfortunately. In Gauteng, I've been able to do 10. Because in Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, they launched a campaign, Cool and Dot, where they are circumcising, they are doing 50 circumcisions every day, and they have to continue like that until. It's a major campaign in the country. We even have maps, I didn't bring them here. That shows the level of the prevalence of HIV AIDS versus circumcision in the whole continent. It shows that countries like Tanzania, where circumcision is very high prevalent, the prevalence of HIV AIDS is lower. In Botswana, where there's no circumcision, the prevalence, it actually shows that. We also have maps that shows that even in the Muslim world, it shows that circumcision, apart from the study that was done in Orange Farm, has got lots of advantages. In South Africa, instead of looking at that, we have got some debate there about what claim to use and all that. That's always unfortunate in the country. We defocus instead of focusing on the work at hand. But that's not the topic for today. The prevention of mother-to-child transmission, PMTC, I've spoken a lot about it. The day I'll sleep in peace is when children are no longer born HIV positive. And that is possible. Safe blood transfusion. Among all these measures, Chairperson, this one we have won with flying colors. While I complain about all this, I can stand in front of you without any fear of contradiction and say South Africa has achieved. The chances of getting HIV/AIDS from transfused blood, if you get it from South African Transfusion Services, will be 1 in 1 million. It's very rare. Because we have unveiled a state-of-the-art equipment at Roodepoort, the headquarters of South African Blood Transfusion Service. because all private hospitals and public hospitals are getting their blood there, I can sleep in peace that you no longer get infected. If you have got an accident or whatever, you need blood. If it happens, it will be a mere accident. That was hell was done with the South African Blood Transfusion Service and PEPFAR, the American HIV AIDS Fund, that they helped us put that state-of-the-art facility, and I'm very proud of that. Post-exposure prophylaxis. With the high incidence of rape and sexual assault, how many women get raped by people who are HIV positive without knowing? They need to go to do this, same thing as doctors are doing. Quite a number of doctors, without your knowledge, are on ARVs. Not because they are HIV positive, but they are exposed. They do operations. When I was at Bar, I was shocked about the level of exposure doctors are exposed to. I met a surgeon who said he's on his fourth course of ARVs. It means he did an operation, was put by a little started ARVs for a month and stopped. Some few weeks later, he gets put by a little again, he must start again. That's how doctors are living in this country. Because they don't know the status, but when you say people must know their status, we start debating about rights, etc. We are exposing health workers. They are very seriously exposed. And imagine if we don't have surgeons and gynecologists because they are running away from this. But they are on post-exposure prophylaxis. But we're saying all pregnant women also. Why am I emphasizing it? Because we have got a very abnormal situation in South Africa. A woman who has been raped goes to a hospital and say, I've been raped. Instead of the hospital staff putting immediately on post-exposure prophylaxis, they ask questions. Did you go to police? Did you report? Do you have a police case number? Are you sure it was raped? It was raped. Can you go to the police station to report the case first and bring the case number? It's very abnormal. I'm saying it's abnormal because when that poor woman gets out of the hospital to go to the police station, she will meet an ambulance at the gate with a syringe blasting, carrying a thug there who was trying to steal. Shot by police, is rushed to hospital and is going to get treated. No questions asked. And I'm not member saying thugs must not be treated, but I'm just contrasting how we treat thugs without asking questions, but women who have been raped, we ask lots of questions. So we called all the CEOs and said it must stop. If a woman comes here and says I was raped, start treatment, ask the questions later. Of course, I know it has got these disadvantages, like the morning after pill, where women don't use contraception, they sleep and go to ask for the morning after pill. I know what it means is that some will go and practice unprotected sex, get scared in the morning and go and say, I was raped, can you give me post-exposure prophylaxis? When she, but those happens in life, and we can't stop treating people because of that. But it's a very important campaign, this. I'm saying so because I want members of parliament to know your constituencies, they must demand this treatment. Rape, post-exposure prophylaxis, we don't know. By the time we know, there is an act in South Africa, by the way, which you passed, I must remind you, that a rape victim can demand by law to know the status of the rapist if he's caught. But what if it takes weeks to catch that rapist? So it's better to start treatment before and you'll do the rest later. You only have 72 hours to save yourself from HIV. So it's very important information. And the last is life skill education, which you know is happening in schools. So this is our arsenal of prevention of HIV and AIDS, Chairperson. And we are running this campaign under the words, I'm responsible. We must take responsibility for our own health and HIV status as individuals. But we must also take collective responsibility. If you have employees, how many of them have tested? If you have got a housekeeper at home, your sexual partners, your employees, what did you ask them? The person working in your constituency office, have they known their status? Or is it a secret thing, a private matter? That working with them, but you can't encourage them? Then, of course, unless Parliament tests first, you can't go and ask those people there. South Africa must take responsibility. We and our social partners must take core responsibility. And that's why we started this campaign for 15 million people. I'm just showing the figures there. But because of the four pandemics, we are not only conducting HIV testing. We must also know your blood pressure, your blood sugar, whether you've got diabetes, your hemoglobin, whether you've got anemia, and do TB screening. You've seen how TB screening our people. and this has been done during the campaign. But most people just did HIV counseling and testing and ignored all these others. What are we hoping to achieve? What is new in this campaign that is different? If there's no campaign, 2.2 million people will test per annum voluntarily if there's no campaign. In this campaign, we're targeting 15 million per annum. Are we going to reach it? Time will tell in July. Again, male and female condoms, we want to increase them tremendously, as I'm showing there. And again, medical male circumcision, it was more pilot project per day, but we want it. Even Global Fund has given us money. We also budgeted for the new financial year that medical male circumcision must be provided in all our health facilities free of charge. That we also need to, those people who are positive, we started what we call INH. INH is isoniazid, the drug against TB. Many people who are HIV positive are sitting ducks to get TB. It's better to put them on isoniazid. For this year, we are targeting 600,000 people who must go on this prophylaxis. Chairperson, as at the end of the financial year last year, February, 923,000 people were on ARVs. But in April, we started this new treatment regimen for the number to increase. So I must show exactly what we have achieved. But what we were estimating is that if we truly test 15 million people, we are going to discover 1.65 million who are positive in terms of our projection. I'm hoping that this doesn't happen, but our studies show that this is likely to happen. 1.65 million people will be. Can I show some of the results? Yeah. Okay. Progress up to so far. Since the campaign started in April, 6 million people were cancelled. This in the public sector, this in the private sector, and this is the total number of those who tested. The total number of those who tested is different from those who are cancelled, as you can see. There's a reason, Chairperson. People come to our stations, get cancelled, listen, and stand up and run home. After cancelling, they just said, well, I've heard your story. But there's another reason. If people come in large number to a state station because the cancelling takes a long time, some become impatient and go away without testing. That's another problem. So for that reason, the figures are not the same. But out of the 6.021 million people who were cancelled, this number got 5.4 million got tested. Acceptance rate is 85. That means at least 85% of those who were cancelled got tested. And the positive ones were found to be 936,168. That means it's an 18% rate. So the target we've reached about those who must cancel is more or less that figure there. By February last year, 1.2 million people were on ARVs. 923,000. That figure has increased to 1.2 million. It's likely to go to 1.5 million this financial year. By February last year, only 490 public facilities were providing treatment for ARV. We're giving ART treatment. But now we have increased the facilities from 490 to 1,500. By February that year, only 290 nurses were licensed to start ARV treatment. We have trained enough nurses. The figure has grown from 290 to 2,000. I mean, 2,000 nurses in South Africa are certified to start this treatment. Thank you, Chairperson. Just one slide. Yes. Yes, dealing with infant mortality. Oh, yeah, okay. Yes. I've already talked about primary health care infant mortality. But the other campaigns will be mass immunization. We have mass immunized children in April, and we have done very well. This is what we have been targeting, some provinces even exceeded. So we have done very well on measles coverage. We can pat ourselves in the back. The vitamin A coverage also we have done very well in most provinces. chairperson, the system of community health workers, why I'm putting here, I'm repeating, unless we've got a good system of primary health care involving community health workers, the issue of maternal mortality and infant mortality cannot be combated in hospitals. Now, what is the situation in South Africa? We have got 65,000 people all over the country, and this is a tragedy, who are prepared to be doing this community health work. But where are they? They are called different names in different corners of the country. Some are in health. No, it's community health workers, home-based care workers, dog supporters, community liaison officers, community development workers. You know, they all have different names, working under different conditions, but they're supposed to be doing the same work. Some are in health, others are in premier's offices, others in social development, some hired by NGOs, supposed to be doing the whole same work. I'm putting this figure because, I mean, this issue here, because all people need to be coordinated to work as one team, doing primary health care, one, not in different departments. The only province that is far advanced in integrating these people is KZN, again, because of what I told you. Their problem of HIV AIDS scared them so much. They've been able to integrate this right up to the world level. And I'm wishing that all the provinces do the same. We need to integrate these people and to introduce the Brazilian model of primary health care. What is the Brazilian model? Which I took all the MECs there to see. In Brazil, they have put up 30,000 primary health care teams, not workers, teams, 30,000. Each team is headed by a doctor. If you don't find the doctor, the most senior nurse, if you don't find the most senior nurse, the one who comes below that, etc., etc. But there is one common person who's always there, whether there's a doctor or a nurse. It's called the community health agent. That person is in the community, appointed by the community, hired by a government. The first thing they did, which impressed me immensely, they are giving families and say, look, you are the community health agent for this number of families. The first thing they do is to go and audit those families, find out who is in that family, what do they have. And they've got that audit. That worker will know that in this family, there are three teenage girls, they all fell pregnant. They are all on contraceptive, they are all going to school. There's an old lady who has got arthritis or diabetes, she's taking treatment. There's an old man who has got blood pressure, they do that. And after taking that audit, they register each one of them in the nearest clinic. So when you go to the clinic, they are already registered. People already know something about you. In our case, it's hit and run. You come to the clinic, we treat you for that day, you disappear, we'll see you next year and ask you, by the way, who you are? Who are you? What are you coming for? And we won't even remember that you were here last year. So that model we want to introduce in our country as one of the ways in which we overhaul the healthcare system. And we've already got 65,000 people who are doing that, but working differently. Chairperson, I was humiliated by an old lady in Guyana who is not supposed to have gone to school. She asked me a question when I went to launch this vitamin A coverage campaign. She said, Minister, tell me, these people who come into our houses, are they not coming from the same government? You wake up in the morning when you start cleaning, one comes in and says, look, I'm a community health worker. You listen. When that one leaves, another one comes in and says, I'm going to talk about immunization. You listen. When you start cooking, another one comes in and says, I'm a home-based care worker. But then she said, aren't they from the same government? Why can't they come together? They're disturbing me. I want to do my work. She was right. But that's what is happening in the country. Without this integration, we need it urgently. And that's one of the plans that we are putting together in the department. Since coming back from Brazil, we've put together a team of experts to start working on that. They've been working on it for the past 8 months. That method is needed so that we, if we had that method, I'll be sitting here and telling you that 15 million people have been tested because we know them. Two last slides about the upcoming campaign. I thought it's important to put them. We are going to need to implement well-known child survival strategies. Every pediatric textbook will tell you, if you want any child in any country in the world to survive, there's one clear strategy, which we just tend to ignore. is called GOBI FFF, an abbreviation for G, meaning growth monitoring. You need to monitor the growth of children. O means oral rehydration. Many children who die, diarrhea kills 5 million children in sub-Saharan Africa every year. They come to hospital already very highly dehydrated because of diarrhea. We need to teach women. They used to be taught in the past. You remember that? Boil water, 1 liter of water, 8 teaspoons of sugar, salt. That saves babies. But because of the hospital-centric, everybody wants medicine and drink. They don't know that that is the best medicine anywhere in the world. And by the way, Chairperson, when you go to hospital, we give you a drip. This child is dehydrated. We give you a drip of sodium chloride. That's exactly 8 teaspoons of sugar and 1 teaspoon of salt in a liter of water, except that it's now put in a drip, and we think it's scientific. You can take it orally at home. So the hospital-centric method kills our people, so oral rehydration is important. The other one, which is going to be a major campaign where we are going to fight, is breastfeeding. Chairperson, the World Health Organization passed a resolution last year about exclusive breastfeeding. It has been proven, we know, children who are exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months stand a very high chance of survival. One of the reasons that we have got a high mortality in South Africa, this is no longer happening. You might have learned or heard that 2 weeks ago the Medical Research Council said they are going to write to government, and I'm eagerly waiting for that letter to instruct us to stop buying infant feeding formulas and providing them, because we are actually contributing to the high mortality. Children must be exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months, and that is whether they are HIV positive or not. And this seems to shock people. But we have discovered, because of the high incidence of HIV in South Africa, people are shying away from breastfeeding. Meaning then that the children won't get HIV/AIDS, but they get killed by other diseases even more than HIV/AIDS. It means it's moving from the frying pan into the fire. That's what is happening in South Africa. For that reason, it is believed that if we start prevention of mother-to-child health transmission, prevention at 14 weeks, and you treat women who need treatment when they still can't 350, why can't the children breastfeed? They will survive. In fact, in the University of KZN, the pediatric unit there, they actually boil the mothers, the milk of HIV-positive mothers, and give to infants, and they survive. In Brazil, they've even gone a step higher. You know, these countries seem to overtake us. They've got what they call a breast milk bank. If I've just told you about blood transfusion, if you have had an accident, we go to the blood bank to get money for you, because the blood transfusion service collects blood all over. We need a breast milk bank. If a child has got an HIV-positive mother who died, you need to go to the milk bank and take human milk, not the cow's milk which you are selling. That cow's milk was made for cows by God, not for human beings. But we thought we were clever to turn it and think children will survive. They simply don't. And there's another good reason. Children are not born with immunity, Chairperson. Every child gets immunity from their mother. And in the infant feeding formulas, nobody has ever been able to, and there will never be in a million years, to put immunity there. It can only be found in the breast milk, because God will remain wiser than all of us. So we must take use of that wisdom from God and make babies survive. So exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months of life saves babies. What is the situation in South Africa is worse than in any country. The statistics, I don't have them here, were provided by the Human Rights Research Council, which is even the worst. 25% of women are doing breastfeeding. The other 25% are doing exclusive. So 25% are doing exclusive breastfeeding. The other 25% are doing using infant feeding formulas. And 51% mixed. That is the most dangerous group in South Africa. To breastfeed a child and give them a bottle later is the most dangerous. That's why most of the children are dying, and I'll tell you why. At all material times, that infant feeding formula will inflate the intestine of the baby. If the mother is HIV positive with inflamed intestine, the HIV AIDS get in easier. Not only HIV AIDS, any other organism, Klebsiella, etc. Like they mentioned there in Charlotte Matrega that they discovered Klebsiella in the milk bottles. Klebsiella is always there. But for children who are breastfed, they are not likely to get it. But those who are bottle fed or mixed fed is worse. So it's better, I will even encourage women, if they don't want to breastfeed, to do exclusive infant feeding, even while I hate it. But to mix the two is death. And unfortunately, that's what 50% of lactating women are doing in South Africa. That's the most dangerous thing to do. But we are in that danger. So we must run a campaign of exclusive breastfeeding for people to understand. The World Health Organization has already passed that resolution in May last year in the World Health Assembly, that in order to save children of the world, they must all go on breastfeeding, regardless of their HIV status. They will be more safe than those who die, of course. I is immunization. I just showed you measles and polio. I forgot to put polio there. We've also immunized 5 million children for polio, and we're doing very well in that regard. We want to continue this year. The three F's. The first F is family planning, which I told you has gone out of the window. Family planning is not of the mother only. It has been shown and proven. When a woman is on family planning, the chance of the child surviving are very high, very, very high. But there's another reason. Women who are on family planning tend to space their children very well. And when they space them, they give them child to time to grow. The other F is female education. And the last F is supplementation, which is adding vitamin A, etc. That one was doing in South Africa, as you know, that most of the milling companies will be asked to add iodine, vitamin A in maize meal. That one was doing food supplementation. The last one is school health programs. I have already mentioned myself and the Minister of Basic Education need to have a school health program. These kids need to be checked at school even before they go to hospital. Nurses must not sit in hospital and wait for kids to get sick. I told you that doesn't work. They must know them while they are at school. These young girls who you saw in front of the star, the nurse should have known that in this school, if we don't act, this is what's like to happen. We won't necessarily have enough nurses, but to me it's better. Much better. If I've got two nurses in the hospital, rather than keep them there and say there are many, many patients, the load is high, I would rather have one going into the community and in the school and one remaining there. The country will have more gains, but unfortunately, our mentality in the country is that no, we believe the machines there will do the trick. So those are the campaigns that are upcoming. For women, I did not add chairperson. The campaign on pap smear. I would be happy if every woman will do a pap smear at least once a year, if not twice. Secondly, have their breast checked, because breast cancer is also on the increase. These are the major campaigns which we want to put together this year. And I've put up together a team to put up these campaigns and how they are going to run. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for this comprehensive and informative and very educating, you know, to all of us. I'm not really going to comment because of time, and I could see the way members were concentrating, and including myself, you know. It's also the way you are presenting, you know, the passion that you have, actually, and the amount of information, you know, that some of us did not have. But most importantly, I think what is most interesting is that this committee is a committee that deals with the very, targets that you highlighted in your presentation, and I think members are really eager to interact with you. Let me give this opportunity to members. Member Robinson, Member Lydia.
Thank you, Chair. And let me add my thanks to you, Doctor, for Minister, for this excellent presentation. Your enthusiasm and your clear thinking is really very welcome, particularly with the turnaround strategy for HIV/AIDS. I share a lot of your concerns about the deep
rural areas particularly, and the fact that clinics are so few and far between, and that very often the services provided there are not adequate. I'm just wondering whether you've got any kind of a turnaround strategy for that. My concern particularly, well, with everything, but especially disability. If you think of how few women are checked before, you know, in the antenatal stage, they get to the hospitals when there's a complication. And having to deal with a complicated pregnancy and the disability that follows, unfortunately, I must say, and I'm sure you're aware of it, we are not doing enough about helping people with disability, the families, the parents, the children. Now, if we can try and turn the antenatal care around, I think that will really help us reduce the burden of the state. Coming on, following on from that, if I may just ask quickly, how effective are your inquiries into the infant and child mortality rates? We've had a few uncomfortable situations where you've had problems at Baragwanath, I think, with the babies, and then, of course, the Freer Hospital. That was a tragic one where babies were dying, far too many of them. Now, I think sometimes the problems are actually management problems, not necessarily healthcare, but it's a combination too, where you're not being perhaps keeping the levels of sterility and so on. But what really bothers me is that I believe that the manager of the Freer Hospital has been reappointed, and that this person was actually not fully qualified or competent for that job. How can we explain that when there is such a concern and passion by you that we have proper training, proper teaching, and the proper person in charge of hospitals so that we can protect our nation?
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Minister. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think, firstly, Chairperson, I want to applaud the Minister about the plans that he has in the department. I think they really should be encouraged, the ones that were listed under upcoming campaigns. I think that should be applauded and encouraged. But my first comment will be with regard to the concern that was raised by the Minister in his presentation with regard to the use of clinics or primary health care services. I think, Minister, I don't know what can be done because there is a problem which I think partly one understands why maybe we have that problem. For instance, in my own experience personally, the clinics that I've visited, I'm not saying all the clinics, but most of them, you find that the kind of service, the way you are treated, the attitudes of the nurses, you know, people are treated as if they are getting a favor, which is something that people decide that I would rather, you know, save money so that I can go to a doctor or to a hospital rather than going there. For instance, I don't know, Minister, whether what can be done to try and ensure that our, you know, clinic staff try to adhere to the Batubidi principles. For instance, I'll make another example. You find that people wake up very early, they go and they stand in queues in the clinics, but then the lunch hour, the clinic just closes. People who were there from 6 o'clock, they must sit for the whole hour waiting for the nurses who have gone for lunch. Why can't we say they will go, you know, in shifts, like you've got the first half going at 12 o'clock, the second half going at 1 o'clock, so that people continue getting the services rather than having to wait for 1 hour, sometimes 2 hours. I've experienced that personally, and I think it's quite frustrating. Then secondly, my comment will be with regard to the maps in your presentation that were showing us the HIV prevalence per district in each province. My question, Minister, is whether do you think or would you say the change from red to orange and from orange to yellow in some of the areas, is it necessarily as a result of the decrease in the infection rates, or is it because people are not going to the clinics, people are not going to the hospitals, or people are not falling pregnant? Because you said you conduct mostly your surveys through pregnant women. Is it necessarily because of the decrease in the infection rates, or is it any other reason that might be a cause of it? change. And also this one is on a lighter note, the accessibility of condoms. As a young person, I remember that at one stage I asked at a garage, you know, that the position where you put your condoms, I think for young people it's very important. Like if a young person has got to go to the counter and ask for a box of condoms, why can't they be at the shelves so that you go and pick it up yourself? Young people will end up, you know, living without buying them because they just feel shy to go and ask the shopkeeper for a packet of condoms. So I think that one also should be looked into if we want to make sure that as many young people as possible do use condoms. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable members,
you
said hello.
Thanks, Chairperson. In the presentation, I was more touched by the need to use clinics. And coming from a rural province, the Northwest province, I know that the luxury of hospitals does not exist there. You have a few hospitals. They're most of them in the little towns. And in the villages, you find a lot of clinics. There are clinics all over there. But the problem with these clinics is that most of them have nurses and work only during the day and have no medicine. There are no doctors at all in these clinics. So maybe it is important to look at the issue of encouraging people to go to clinics, but also making clinics to have the necessary things, particularly medication, for them to be able to assist people. I know I'm speaking here of a practical situation that I'm involved in our villages around Mafikeng, Zeraft, and all those particular areas in the rural Northwest.
I take the rest of the hands so that when the minister responds, you know, responds well. I will take member Lisa, and then member Kiki.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Minister, for the presentation. I just want to know how long will Kulandoda get to other provinces? Because I know it's only in Gauti. So how long will it take before it goes to other provinces?
Thank you, Minister. This was an eye-opening topic.
Thank you, Minister. This was an eye-opening. It's a pity that he's already passed 4-4, so we won't have much time to deliberate on these issues because this is very important. We live in the communities with the people, most people that are affected. You know, Minister, what I always have a question in my mind because in Parliament we have qualified nurses, qualified social workers, but in whatever plan that is coming up or now that you're talking about the mass mobilization that we have these people in Parliament and they are not made of any use. I mean, if we need more people to volunteer in the community, I think those who are who have those particular qualifications as members of parliament, they should be part of the volunteers in the communities. Because honestly, most of the time, members of parliament are not in parliament. They are out there doing constituency work. But I think it would be good if they could be utilized, all the professionals that are in parliament, they could be utilized in their profession, in their field of profession. Secondly, I'm looking at the Western Cape because I'm coming from the Western Cape. And the Karoo. I don't know whether you have taken into consideration that Karoo is a poverty-stricken area, and when I look at the rate of HIV AIDS in Karoo, it's very high. And I remember years back, we were looking at this problem when it started in Karoo, and one of the reasons is that Karoo is a junction. Beaufort West is a junction. All the trucks via Beaufort West, and that might be one of the reasons why if Beaufort West is so affected with this particular problem. I don't know whether you have taken into consideration that one when you look at the problems that might be the cause in some of the areas or districts. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks, Minister, for the presentation. In your plan, Minister, I hope you are going to be looking at rehabilitation of clinics, because I think a lot of problems happen because most of these clinics need rehabilitation, and there are those clinics which are 8-hour or 24-hour but using solar panels for electricity. If and when women come to deliver, particularly at night, it becomes problematic because at times gas is used to some of the clinics. The other issues, Minister, that I would like you to clarify, in they believe that they must only have a CD4 count done to check on they want to check on their CD4 count. Wherever you are, to have their viral loads checked. They are not interested in having their viral loads checked. They just want CD4 count, and they go for CD4 count even every 3 months, which I don't think is necessarily important, but can you explain on the importance of the two, CD4 count and viral load, then?
Thank you, Minister. Let me just take the last bite before you respond. I think I want to actually join the members who are really saying the primary care, health care, seem that it's so important and it's the one nearest to our people. I don't think the community prefer going to hospitals, because some of them, you find that they don't even have, you know, money to go to hospitals. But it is the kind of service provided, you know, by the nurses at the clinic in terms of their attitude. I think one of the members already highlighted it there. But I think we also have to be grateful to the information provided with, because we work with constituencies, and this information is going to help us, you know, to spread it. As we say that, you know, it's educating the community. And I think we are also nearest to the community. The one question I have, Minister, I just want to find out as to what are the key challenges that are facing, that the department is faced with in terms of data collection, and what is it that the department is doing to improve the data collection so that we can effectively monitor the Millennium Development Goals.
Thanks a lot. Let me start with this question, simply because the maps are there. that what brings the changes from red to yellow, etc. There's actually no change or no appreciable change. I was showing over a period of 4 years. If you check there, the differences are not much. It will be a change if most of these rates move from one province to the other, but it's within the same province. Maybe I'll confuse you. Let me try to show you what I'm talking about. In other words, the changes are not that significant. They still show that over 4 years, it's the same areas which have got the biggest load, but they just keep on. You know, let me give you this example. This is 2007. OR Tambo is 30%. The color has changed because between 30 and 40, 30.3, between 30 and 40 is that color. But if you check in 2009, it was 28.9, a difference of 0.2. But because the key there shows that yellow is between 20 and 30, we show it as change. That change is not significant. I wonder whether you understand what I mean. It's not a significant change. It still shows that OR Tambo over 4 years, look, 29.7, 30.3, 29.6, 29.8 is the same thing. In fact, it's showing that is the same distance which have got the problem. It would have been very different if this one suddenly moved from here to 30, for instance, but you see it's always around 22, 20, 23, 24. So the changes is just variations over years to years. You know, that's all. And perhaps the other one which will make you understand is the Western Cape. Here. No, Northern Cape. Where is Northern Cape? Yes. If you check here, 5.3, 7.3, 2.2, 0.0. There are very few people here. So this year, that is 0.0. It's not because there were no people found positive. It's because there is a number which we have chosen as the minimum number of women who are pregnant whom we must test. That year, that number was not reached. That means the number of women who were pregnant was so small that we thought it's not important to study it, and we put 0.0. So it's more or less the same year by year. But what the maps show is that, I mean, every year is the same districts that have got problems. Look. Even if Kenneth Kaunda there has changed a little bit, but it has only changed to 29 from 32, 35, 34. So the differences are just variations, but the problem remains in the same district. Thanks. I just wanted to show that because the maps were there, Chairperson. The other one, the turnaround strategy for clinics, including clinics and etc. We are busy with it. It's only that I was not presenting NHI. In preparation for NHI, we have done a lot of work. We have mapped all our health facilities, and by June, we'll have finished. We have done audit and mapping. The mapping has already been completed, and we even have the maps. In other words, I can show you where each and every hospital is on the map, where each and every clinic. We know, as I'm sitting here, we discovered in those maps that Mpumalanga has got lesser clinics than any part of the country. That's why, I don't know why, but I just found that it was like that, and it shows on our primary health care utilization. Apart from Gauteng, Mpumalanga is also bad in primary health care utilization because they don't have clinics. I still don't know why. So when we go to build clinics, we're going to concentrate there, especially Kertsibanda, where you know the HIV AIDS is the worst. Their clinics are scattered. You saw a small number in standard care, and the rest of the area, there are no clinics. So we know because of those maps. Secondly, in the maps, we have got a group of experts who are doing what they are called polygons. They've been able to map the distances and accessibility of clinics to villages and the number of populations and the transport routes. We do have them. It's only that I'm not unveiling them today. The day we come to unveil, I can show you in each and every district, each and every health center, that this number of people can access the health center because there's a road, etc. We all have those studies. It's only that it was not day to talk about them today. But it's important if this issue of access is to be resolved. Because you can build a clinic, people have got no access to it, doesn't help. And that's already showing, Chairperson, because we have discovered that 41% of clinics in South Africa were actually built after 1994. In the past 16 years, 41% of clinics. But the utilization has gone down. It means there's something wrong. There's something wrong with the methods we're using, which needs to be corrected. The other issue about inappropriate qualification, I can't argue against this. Even the president has said it. The president of the ruling party. Not necessarily as the president of the country. If you look to the January 8th statement of the ruling party, the president repeated that twice about the issue of qualifications. It means it's troubling us. And one of the reasons that he did so, I went to show him that no, there are areas where, because I don't appoint CEOs in hospitals, but I've noticed that hospitals do so. I mean, provinces do so. And in most of the time it happens in rural provinces where they go and get a teacher and make them the CEO of a hospital. I've got nothing against teachers, but you are trained to teach children, not to run a hospital. Well, you know, it's amazing if you could see actually some of the appointments made and you ask yourself, why? I don't get answers, but I am made to understand that people abused a policy by the Department of Health, which was introduced about 12 years ago, which was also a mistake, whereby they said in England and Australia, for instance, when they choose managers of hospital, you don't necessarily have to be a doctor or a nurse or health trained. You only have management skills. But what was left behind was that in those countries, there is an MBA health services. If you don't have it, you will never be given a CEO's position. In other words, you go for 4 years, you are not a doctor, but you go for 4 years to do a degree that teaches you how to manage a hospital. Now, that was left behind. And they said, no, you don't have to be a doctor. But what provinces did was, you must never be a doctor to manage a hospital. The way they did it. Especially, the worst offenders is Limpopo and Eastern Cape. Those are the worst offenders in the country. And they are the most rural and the most problematic. And that's why, you know, so we are busy looking into that and we'll have to find corrective measures. It has to be corrected. Otherwise, if the hospital itself is not well managed, that brings to the issue of drug stockouts. It is to do with management. People believe it's because the government is not buying. I know it because Free State ran out of ARVs in 2008. You know that. In 2009, to stop this, PEPFA gave us 900 million rand as a donation to make sure that people don't run out of ARVs. But towards the end of the year, some ran out of ARVs. We know we have bought them. Because, you know, so one of the things we have done, which we have agreed with the MEC, four groups of drugs, ARVs, TB, maternal health drugs, and drugs for child health care, like, vaccines, we have agreed that the procurement will be central. And we are doing so, at least with these four. I'm not saying the others are important, but ARVs, vaccines, maternal, you know, drugs used in pregnancy and childbirth and TB, must never run out of them. If you run out of ARVs, it's not only that people are going to die, you're also developing resistance to the present regime. And if you develop resistance to the regime, we are forced to move you to the next regime, which is even more expensive. So it causes more problems to the country. So it's an issue of management, but we are looking at it, they've agreed. Fortunately, the Global Fund gave us money to establish a central procurement authority, and we are going to do so. The issue of attitude of staff, it came many times in many questions here. Attitude of nurses, etc. And you are right, very, very right. What we have done, you are aware that from yesterday, and it's coming to you, members. From yesterday, we officially issued a government gazette of a bill that has already gone through cabinet, and it's on its way to parliament, but from yesterday it was released to the public for the next 3 months to establish an office of standard compliance. If you don't put such an office, we'll keep on raising this issue. What is the Office of Standard Compliance going to do? an independent office reporting to the minister, but independent. What is he going to do? We have selected certain standards which we think are basic, that every healthcare facility, whether it's a clinic or a hospital, even a private health sector institution, have to comply to those standards. Some are complex, others are basics, which even members of society can know because they are simple. And the simple ones are only six. Number one is cleanliness. I'm afraid I have to mention cleanliness and I'm embarrassed because I'm not supposed to be talking about it. It's supposed to be automatic. Because a hospital is supposed to be the cleanest public space in the country. But unfortunately, it's not. Some are so dirty, you can't believe it. So we are putting it at the standard that must be achieved. The second one is the attitude of staff that we are talking about. The attitude of staff to patients. I've said this to CEOs, and I said, according to me, if the attitude of staff is bad, it's a reflection on the manager. I said that, and people are saying, no, I'm being unfair to CEOs. You see, leadership in life, where you deal with lots of people, becomes very important. Same as schools. Most of the schools that are not functioning very well, it's not because they have got no computers and laboratories, and many people say those things are important, but if you get the worst principal, those things will never work for you. That I can assure you. But people keep on pressing on this, and no, unless we get, you know, there are principals, and I'm not saying I'm encouraging this, who are able to get good results under a tree. Yes, because they know how to run a school. The laboratories and the libraries will give them distinctions. Then it will just be an add-on. But if you have got them, you have got no principal, you won't even get an ordinary pass, not to mention distinction. Same as hospitals. Leadership is very important. The nurses who close and rush for lunch and all that, it means the CEO of that hospital has forgotten about that clinic. In their mind, it doesn't even exist. Because in the first place, it should be sending supervisors there to know that it's running very well. So the Office of Standard Compliance will look into that cleanliness and attitude of staff. Three, infection control. You have spoken about it. And it was there in the papers about poor infection control. It's one of the standards. One of the problems is when the Department of Health did OSD, there are infection control nurses appointed. Many of them did not find themselves on the OSD and they left. It's important for every hospital to have an infection control nurse. What is an infection control nurse? It's a no-nonsense nurse who understands this germs on organism. Ordinarily, we don't understand them. You can think that this place is very clean. An infection control nurse will know the curtains, the washing of hands when you get into the ward. They will always teach you because they are trained, because it's very important, because the germs you can't see with your own eyes. Now, if there are no infection control nurses, that situation that happened in Freya and Charlotte McCraig, etc., will keep on repeating itself. It's important. But the situation in Charlotte McCraig, as you know, it's not only infection control. There was also overcrowding, which I showed you how it happened. But all those things will be solved by this issue of standards, because every person who wakes up will know that these are the standards. The CEO will be pressurized. At the moment, if a child dies in a hospital or there's a problem, the long queues and all that, ordinarily, the minister is to blame. The CEO is sitting there, is not worried. No, nobody ever mentioned them. It's always the minister who fails. And the CEO will sit and relax and say, no, they don't see me, they don't know me. They can't mention me. So there's no pressure. But if there's a pressure to meet particular standards, even if the minister is not watching, the CEO will be forced to wake up. The fourth standard is the stock out, the drug stock out. How is this that this clinic ran out of drugs when the government has bought them? I called a meeting of CEOs and I asked them how many of them ever visited the pharmacies in their hospitals. Many of them looked at each other or looked down. In other words, he's running a hospital but never imagined that he's responsible for the pharmacy. Yes, he's never been there, not even paid a visit. And I know how these things happen. Because I worked in rural areas. You see, in the rural areas I've worked, I've never seen a single pharmacist. They are not there. The people who are giving you the drugs are not pharmacists. They are on-the-job trainees. That means we took one person, trained them on the job. Say, when the doctor wrote this, this is how many we give. Some are pharmacists, but not qualified pharmacists. So a manager of that hospital needs to know that and how to help them. Chairperson, I was working one rural hospital in Sukune where everything I ordered, they wrote OS. OS. OS means out of stock. Out of stock. Out of stock. One day I said, no, man, everything I know is out of stock here in this hospital. What am I going to prescribe? I stood up and I went to the pharmacy. I found that most of the things I've prescribed are there. But it's written out of stock. Why? Because I was an intern. Many interns are taught chemical names of drugs. They don't talk about Panado, they talk about paracetamol. Panado is a commercial name. Many of the on-the-job training people know these names, like Panado, etc. So if you prescribe chemically like you are taught pharmacology at medical school, they won't know. And it is the leader of that hospital who must coordinate that and say, this one is an intern, this one is a pharmacy assistant. No, they just work in their own corners. And the right over stock. And because of that, I found that most of the drugs have expired. And they push them aside. And they are there. Then the members of the public, they are not there. But the government is buying them. So these are issues of management. And we are leading to that. In the Central Drug Authority, we have developed that chain to see how we actually solve that problem. In other words, we need the mechanism that will know that in this clinic, 2 weeks before something is out of stock, we already know about it. Not on the day when patients want it. And so the long queues is the other standard. Then the last one is safety and security. There are six standards in terms of this act. When you interact with that act, look at it and see if you've got something to add, because it's going to come to Parliament. What will this office do? It will have three units. The first unit will be that of inspectors. You need to have an inspector who wakes up and gets into any hospital unannounced and check the standards. If he announces himself, they start putting things right. They do that in most of the cases. I once visited the hospital, I won't name it. I was very happy. It was so clean. And I mentioned it. But one doctor called me aside and said, hey, I've been working here for 10 years. I'm also seeing it clean for the first time today. Because they knew I was coming. Yes. And that doctor told me the truth. He said, look, I don't want to put my CEO in trouble, but I've never seen this hospital clean. I'm happy because today is clean. So it means they can clean it. But it's deliberate, you know? That is not being cleaned. So there must be inspectors who come at any time unannounced. That's one office. In this Office of Standard Compliance. The story is one unit. The second unit will be a unit of accreditation. Before the National Health Insurance is implemented, every health facility must be accredited. That means only when it meets the standard, it gets accreditation, and then it can go under NHI. If it does not get accreditation, then you can't send people there under NHI because money will just disappear. It must meet the standard. This Office of Standard Compliance, we are mapping it upon the similar office in Britain. This issue of infection control and babies dying, people believe it's happening for the first time in South Africa. It happened in Britain, where many children died because of staff, because of poor infection control in hospitals. And it was a big scandal around Bristol. And they put the Office of Standard Compliance to deal with these matters. And they helped us to produce this bill on how they actually did it. And we brought them here to workshop us and all that, you know. So that Office of Accreditation will accredit and say, yes, this hospital. In Britain, they actually grade them. They say it's hospital A up to F. You can know in your village that my hospital was graded F, and that one is graded A. The problem with that, which we are going to do, but we must find a solution, is in the village, if they say my hospital is F, I'm going to ask, why in that village is A, and here you guys will give us F? And we say, no, it's your management. And the villages will say, no, but we don't appoint the managers, it's you. Why do you give us F managers when others are having A managers? It will become an issue, but it will help. In Britain, they haven't resolved that, but they say it happens and people get unhappy. But at least they know. And the manager, they know that they are watching me, that I've been graded F, I must pick up my socks. You know? And then The last office is Ombudsperson, which people are debating about. Some are saying it's not new. All we mean by the Umbas person is if the standards of long queues and all that, somebody mentioned going to clinic and nurses just leaving you there to go for lunch and all that. Somebody ought to, there must be an office where you go to complain and say, I went to this hospital, I went there for 8 hours, and they ignored me completely. I'm sure many of you here will remember Mahatma Gandhi Hospital in Durban, where in 2005 there was massive Klebsiella deaths of babies there. They have turned that situation around. I visited there, the first thing I saw, that hospital is spotlessly clean. And they said that the death of those babies checked them up. They have to sit down and think. It's spotlessly clean. The second thing, they've reduced the waiting times in the pharmacy from 4 hours to 30 minutes. They've been able to do that. We never send them anything extra. They just divide means and they've done so. So these things are possible when you pressurize people. And that office we think will pressurize them. And I'm chairperson, I'm looking forward to that office of standard compliance. If you check the National Health Act, it has been provided by the past 6 years, but we never introduced it. So we are not introducing a new act. We just took the National Health Act. We are adding an amendment on it in order to introduce this office. And I'm looking forward. The other question is about accessibility of condoms. You're 100% spot on, and I'm embarrassed, but I must mention it. You mentioned the garage. Even our own clinics. A lot of clinics where you'll go in and ask for condoms and the nurse will look at you. What are you asking for? We don't do such things here. In a country with such high HIV prevalence, it's a reality. So it's not only in the garage, but you even in the hotels during 2010, we still want to call these hotel owners. I'm not against religion. Many hotels keep a Bible in every room. Yes. And they buy it with their own money, I'm sure, or they get it from wherever. I understand these are donations. We want them to keep condoms in a similar way. So those who don't go through the Bible and don't get convinced must have condoms nearer, because some will read the Bible and understand that I shouldn't do this. Because we don't control human beings. And I'm asking this hospitality industry to please do that, because we are in a danger zone. We are in a country where life is at stake. But I would love a situation where garages, clinics, hotels, condoms are all over. Members, this issue, is very painful. I started seeing condom dispensers in Germany in 1988 in toilets, public toilets. And I asked, they said, no, there is a disease called HIV. That was 1988. 23 years ago, they were already doing this. If you go to Brazil, their first project or plan to fight HIV/AIDS started in 1986. That was 6 years after HIV came into being. Long before, we here were still thinking about our liberation when it started. The Brazilian had already started fighting. They already put a program in 1986. That is 25 years ago. Then in 1996, 10 years later, they started universal treatment. That was 4 years before we took each other to court, whether we must treat or not. They were already doing so. I went to India in December, and I'm going to answer this question about truck drivers because it's important also. I came back. I'm not sure, Chairperson, whether I will say I was encouraged or discouraged. I thought we were doing a lot in fighting HIV/AIDS until I went to India, which have got doesn't have our prevalence. India has got 1.3 billion. They've got 1.3 billion people and only 2 million people HIV positive. We have got 49 million people and 5 million people positive. But if you can see their battle plan, you realize why I said I was discouraged. I was discouraged because I thought we were doing a lot until I saw what other people are doing. But I was encouraged because I saw that it is possible. In fact, in India, they've got the Director General of Health, which we do have. We've got the DG of Health here. But they also have a DG of HIV/AIDS in the Department of Health. There are two DGs. One is dealing with health, as you know it here. The other is dealing with HIV/AIDS only, with staff. They put them there. When they wake up, their language is HIV. That's how other people are fighting these diseases, including providing condoms and all that. If you go to the city of Bangalore in India, they will show you a database of all the sex workers. They know them by name. It's not like us where you say, I'm going to deal with sex workers and give them condoms. They know them by a name. They know that this one is a sex worker, is staying here. This is the phone number. And they go and service them. They've got that database. It's a very beautiful project. Now the truck drivers, they also have that. And it's true. Check the maps. This question was very brilliant, actually. I don't know why I forgot it. Let's check KZN. Let's look at the red areas. KZN has got a problem of HIV AIDS, I told you, because of circumcision problem. But other districts are red all the time than others. It's a quick question mark. What's happening in these areas? If you check these areas very well, you realize that it is at the area where N1 and N2 are operational. The trucking business, moving from Itequini to Mgungundlovu to Uthukela, that's N3, and this is more or less N2, same as there. And if you move to other provinces, you'll find the same thing. So meaning that the project dealing with truck drivers, we have to start it. And I've just, the people who were funded and done that project in India is Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I met them on Friday because they are the ones who took us to India. In fact, what they are doing there, all the truck drivers working together with the Department of Transport and Companies, they've got their database. They know that this driver is driving a truck from here to there so many times a month. And along the routes, they don't stop on the roads as they do in South Africa. They've got tracking services there, which are actually HIV AIDS point. When you stop there, you go in there, they do voluntary counseling, they do testing, they give you condoms and they write your name down. If after a month they don't see you there, they phone the company to ask if you are still working there. Say, no, this truck driver, we haven't seen him passing here for ages. What's happening to him? They check sexually transmitted diseases. So it's a very involved program. That is what South Africa needs. And we are putting that program into being. I actually made it by yesterday. You'll see it's solving this type of problems. I never thought I would find myself sitting with sex workers in the same room talking. We did that in India. They were there. I sat with them. I even had photos where they were telling me about their job and their problems and how the government is helping them solve their problems. And they were very open because they are on the database. They are known. Here they are anonymous. Yes. If you start and say, hey, they've got the right, and, you know, so... But other countries are persistent. Unless we become persistent in the solution, these things will continue. So the drug one, the drug drivers, we must study to help these provinces. The resources in the clinics. One day I'm going to show you a slide because we have already done it, this audit I'm talking about. By June this year, I will unveil in the Department of Health, a project where at the press of a button in any province, you see all the health facilities. At the press of another button, you can zoom into one facility. It shows you what facilities they've got in that clinic or hospital, what is the staff like, etc., etc. We are doing that for NHI because we need to know these things so that we can start giving clinics resources. And I agree, Chairperson, of the statement you said, that is not that some of the people don't want to go to clinics. If the clinic is working very well, I agree they'll go. But the mentality not to go is because they saw them not working. I was in one province, let me not name it. One CEO told me a very story that made me angry. She said, in that hospital, they used to have a roster of doctors in that hospital visiting the clinics. You know, going out. Every day there was a roster. And the province changed the policy and said, no, if a doctor gets an accident with this government car, they are liable, they must pay, etc. So the doctors refused to go. What they did, they waited the hospital for the patients to come. Patients come from all corners, overcrowding. And they know about it. I said, why did you leave this policy? They said, no, it comes from the provincial government. It's the wrong policy. It's the wrong policy. Give doctors cars to go out and treat patients out there. Then they won't have to come and crowd overcrowd the hospital. They'll be happy, they'll get confident that even when I go to the clinic, I will find a doctor. One chairperson, one businessman asked me a question which is important. He said, Minister, and it was only a month after I was appointed, he said, tell me what's happening. He said, in the past, when I get a small cut, I'll go to the clinic. I'll find the nursing sister there who will put two stitches and I'll go back home. He said, now last week I went to a clinic with a small cut here. I was using a knife, I cut myself. They sent me to hospital, and then I waited there for 10 hours. He said, I'm self-employed, I can't afford 10 hours. That was an ordinary person giving me this story. And it's true. Why is that happening? I'm shocked. Because I was taught how to suture by nurses, not by doctors. Nurses knew how to suture more than me. But I understand this work is now given to doctors, even including putting up drips. I was taught by nurses. Many doctors don't know how to put a scalp vein here on babies. It's nurses who have got that expertise. But all of a sudden, they'll tell you that no, nurses can no longer do that. So one of the problems is the training of nurses itself. So in March this year, we are calling the biggest nursing summit. We need to change this situation. And people get angry, but I must mention this is a fact. In 1986, 4 years before liberation, this country took a decision of training nurses only at university. They come back with a lot of theory, but no practice. And when you say so, they say I undermine them. It's a fact. The Secretary General of ANC in one meeting was putting it this way, Gretaman Dasha, because he was also union. He said, look, Minister, I don't know how to evaluate a nurse. But he said, my method is simple. If I go to a hospital and I must get a drip, if she pokes me once and misses, pokes me for the second time and misses, poke me for the third time and I start bleeding, I know it's not a nurse. He said, that is my evaluation. And he said, this is happening quite often these days. Nurses used to be experts in these things. All of a sudden, we changed the training method of nurses and put it theory. Precisely. That is my dream. And this summit is all about that. If you decide, policemen have got degrees. You are aware. They've got police degrees. If all policemen went up and go to university to get a degree, I'm sure you know thugs will drop at them. They'll never chase a single thug. But they fight here on the ground, they understand, and they go and get degrees later, police degree. But you start here. Same as soldiers. There's no police general, a soldier who's a general without having been a rifleman. So we've got a situation where nurses come back as commanders to command somebody. That even changed the pyramid. We've got more professional nurses than staff nurses now in South Africa. Yes, there are 98,000 professional nurses and 35,000 staff nurses. The 98,000 professional nurses want to be all commanders. But who do they command? It's nobody. And it becomes a war because in the hospital, when you give them a job, they say, no, but I'm a commander. You know, so it's not undermining nurses. It's to say nursing is a bedside experience. You start there at the bedside and you move upwards. We have actually demolished that, unfortunately, in favor of theory. We must actually do that. The second thing it did, I was phoned by a young lady who wanted me to help and said, look, can you help me with 35,000 rand? I want to go to a nursing college. I said, what? Is that the fee? You know where I got scared? Because in the past, it was the other way around. Yes, a child from a poor family can go and start nursing and get a salary at the end of the month. Now they must get 35,000, meaning poor children can no longer train in nursing. That's what it means. Lastly, it has even caused something that embarrassed me. In Northwest, the North wanted to take us to court because the student nurses went on strike. Now, what was the court case all about? Even the definition of a student nurse. Is a student nurse a worker or a student? Go to all our provinces. Some provinces will say, no, he's a worker. He's on our personal system. Others will say, no, we have given them a brother, he's a student. Then they say, no, let's go to court for the judge to decide. I mean, how does the judge decide the definition of a nurse? It's us. Then I ask the nurse, please remove this from court. Let's sit in this summit and resolve this issue. It's a policy issue. How do we train a nurse? How do we define them? It's us. And of course, we need members of parliament to help us. How long will Kulandoda go to other provinces? Kulandoda is a circumcision program of Gauteng. The other provinces must do theirs. They don't have to name it. Yes, it's theirs. In KwaZulu-Natal, they do it differently. They call it something else. Kulandoda is in Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. They've established a unit there. You go there, they can do 50 a day. In KZN, they don't do that. They put up camps in colleges, etc. Take doctors and social workers there, traditional healers. They do on a mass basis, and you know. So it's an outdoor program. Each province must do that. The bottom line is you must have a circumcision program. Whether you do it the Kulandoda way or the KZN way, it's your own problem, but let there be some program like that. Members doing voluntary work, yes, no, I'll appreciate it. Especially the older members. You know, older nurses, older social workers, very good. I've already said so. And you remember when we did the AC campaign, we invited them, but many of them did not have money for stipend and transport. We are still organizing them. I still want them. Can you imagine if an elderly nurse who is retired, I put that nurse in a school and say from 8 o'clock to 4, please help these kids. These girls who are falling pregnant with a motherly nurse who understand these issues, it will improve the situation. Yes, so we are actually looking into that. The issue of viral load. We will look into all these problems because we are devising what they call a point of care facility. That means machines where people are tested right where they are in the clinics. We are looking into that and will be unveiling some of these point of care facilities very soon. I think I've mentioned most of the issues that needs to be mentioned, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I wish we could raise, because we still have a lot to, you know, to raise from myself, from the members I know. But unfortunately, there is a study group that is due to start at 5 in this committee room, which we will have to, you know, so if the minister... Okay, let me just then take this opportunity to once again thank the minister, and I've already indicated that we still have a lot that we would like to engage with the minister, as this has been a valuable, you know, information. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, members. I think without much ado, let me close this.